This is the Dan Brevik interview for July 17th, 2006.
Hello,
this is Anthony Young calling for Dan Brevik.
Yes, that's me.
Hi, Dan. How are you?
I'm fine, Anthony. How are you?
Okay. I got your email today.
Oh, okay.
With the additional information on dates and people.
Yep.
And so forth. So let me get started. Briefly, let me give you a bit more background about myself. I've been writing and publishing books since the early 80s. In the beginning, it was primarily automotive post-war history. A couple of years ago, I wrote an article on the lunar rover for a car magazine, and I got the bug real bad. I started interviewing the Apollo J mission astronauts. The interviews went so well, I had a mountain of information, and all this other information came forth. And I just had this puny little article, and the light went on that maybe there was a book there. And to make a long story short, the Lunar Rover book, The Wheels of Apollo and the Quest for Mars, will be published in this fall. And the book publisher said, okay, now what are you going to do? And I had been thinking a book about this because there have been a lot of books written on the Saturn development,
yep.
Apollo program in general.
Oh, yeah.
But nothing on the F1 engine. I found that curious and figured, well, I'd better find out.
It's curious because there's quite a story to it.
Mm-hmm. And so I started doing my research and wondering if there were really enough people 40 years after the fact to interview. There are fewer than, as understandable, I would like, but I think I've got enough to, along with all the other information, to put together a pretty good book. So.
Mm-hmm.
So let me get started here. Actually, I was kind of surprised that your years at Rocketdyne were rather brief.
Yep.
But it was very hectic, and I guess you packed more into a few years than most people pack into 10 or 15. So.
Easily.
Okay. Let me start out with this. I'm kind of curious. When you started working on the F1 program, how many people would you say were on the project at Rocketdyne?
I was in combustion devices,
mm-hmm.
which was strictly the thrust chamber injector dome.
Okay.
So we didn't have anything to do with turbo pumps or putting it together as a system.
Okay, gotcha.
And I would say there were, in that F1 group, there were maybe, on the order of 20.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Because I know I'm looking at the diagrams here, there is the thrust chamber, and what this illustration shows is the thrust chamber nozzle extension.
Yeah, we had the nozzle extension too.
Okay. Now, technically speaking, did the cooling tubes run the entire, from top to bottom, on the thrust chamber, or was it just the tubes on the lower chamber extension?
It was from the injector down to, I think it was a 7-to-1 ratio.
Okay.
And from that point on, it was a gas-cooled extension down to the 10-to-1.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Originally, it was to be ablative.
Mm-hmm.
And that didn't work. So they had to rush through a design that was after I left. And Jack Sellers did that.
Okay. Let me back up a little bit here. When you started working on the project, what were your specific tasks that he was at? I guess it was Lou that you were reporting to, is that right?
No, I didn't report to Lou, I reported to Joe.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Lou and I were peers.
Joe Erbs. Okay. Because
things were different in those days. It was, get this mother to work,
mm-hmm.
basically. I didn't have specific tasks. In fact, Lou and I divided things up according to our interests. I'm a chemical engineer, he was a mechanical engineer.
Mm-hmm.
And he got into the fabrication of the tubes, brazing them together
okay.
in the furnace. He had quite a story to tell, too. Whereas my concern was, let's not let it melt. So it was the cooling.
Okay.
The coolant. Now, the original design had been done by A.J. Boxstaller on the tubes and the bundle, the number of tubes and so on, but I took it over and basically it was make sure it doesn't melt, which means the manifolds.
Mm-hmm.
So I did a lot of calculations, heat transfer calculations, stress calculations, stuff like that.
What was the thrust chamber temperature on average?
Of what?
After the injector, I guess in the mid part of the thrust chamber, what were the temperatures that were estimated or found?
Oh, 5,000, 5,500 Fahrenheit, someplace in there.
Okay. Okay, yeah, exactly. How not to let it melt.
Yeah, right. That was a problem everybody has.
Well, the first thrust chambers, from what I read in your letter, was the first was actually a solid bell. Is that right?
Yes, that's typical for development of a rocket back then. Just a solid, not even a bell, it was a conical, a cone-shaped easier machine. And it was strictly to test the injector dome assembly, because that was always the biggest problem, getting those things to work.
Yes. I've done a lot of reading on the design, well, I'm just getting into it actually, the design of the injector and how it was had to be reworked in order to control this combustion and stability.
Yeah, many times, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay, then can you describe a little bit more detail then your work on that the thrust chamber, some of the things you were tasked with or what you worked on. I'm trying
right.
to get a grip on that.
Since first of all, we didn't have a thrust chamber.
Mm-hmm.
That we had the mock-up. Now, I explained in that letter to my grandson, the mock-up is at the Smithsonian right now.
Okay.
Yeah, that's nice to know, the JAC.
Yeah, that's in the Air and Space Museum.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Have you seen it?
No, I have not. You know, I've never been up there, and I've been reading some, and they've got a new one now outside of Washington.
Right.
And that's interesting in itself, so I'm going to plan a trip around those, too.
That'd be a good idea. We didn't have any thrust chamber built up.
Mm-hmm.
Just the mock-up. And we weren't going to get one built up until we could figure out how to braze them all together, which was Lou's task.
Okay.
I then wrote programs to calculate, and since I had no other choice, to calculate what would happen based on previous experience with smaller engines and chemical engineering principles, thermodynamics and all.
Mm-hmm.
So I started out by doing it all on slide rule and a Monroe Multimatic calculator. That's what we used around then, mechanical calculator. Then I graduated to the computer. I found out what you could do with it.
Okay.
And I wrote programs in Fortran, the original Fortran.
Ah, okay.
These programs then, they got more and more elaborate, and I was able to demonstrate heat transfer problems we were going to get into, and the phenomena called starvation. Now, starvation occurs when you have the manifolds. You familiar with where the manifolds are?
Yes, I'm looking at the illustration here.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
The hypergol manifold.
Hypergolic? That would be for the igniter source.
Okay.
There's manifolds, fuel manifold in particular.
Okay.
The fuel input manifold. Now, in that manifold feeds the down the tube bundle.
Okay.
And then there's a small manifold at the end of the tube bundle where the fuel turns around and comes back an up tube.
Mm-hmm.
And then into another manifold, which then feeds it into the injectors.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Got it.
Now, it's a principle of fluid flow called Bernoulli's principle that the faster the fluid flows,
mm-hmm.
the lower the pressure, the static pressure gets. You trade off one for the other.
Right.
And in the manifold, if the cross-sectional area is too small, you will get a very high flow rate at the inlet. And as the fuel feeds off into the tubes, as you go around the manifold, the pressure, the flow rate, rather, will go down. You follow that?
Yes, I do.
And consequently, the static pressure will go up.
Right.
Now, what happens then is you have an imbalance of static pressure, which is what drives the fluid down the tubes.
Mm-hmm.
And you will get a phenomenon called starvation. At the feed point, the velocity is so high that the static pressure gets low and it can't push as much fluid through as it does toward the end of the manifold.
Okay.
That means then that you're going to have hot spots along those tubes because you don't have quite the flow. That's called starvation.
Now, the fuel that you speak of, is this oxidizer, kerosene, or both?
It
is the kerosene, okay.
Yeah, the kerosene.
Okay.
We didn't cool with, you don't do anything with oxygen except burn it.
I understand now, okay. I wanted to clarify that because some people have the misnomer that, that frigid oxygen, that's what cooled it.
No,
okay.
Now, in a hydrogen engine, it's true that you use the liquid hydrogen to cool.
Okay.
But that's for other reasons, not because of its temperature.
Okay, well, the tube bundle for the thrust chamber was key to keeping this thing cool. Was it patterned, I assume it was patterned after some previous engine design?
Oh, yes. The very first, that dates back to the early Atlas.
Okay.
The 150K engine.
Mm-hmm.
And let's see, it may have gone back to the Redstone, but I can't remember.
I don't know if the Titan engines had...
Titan was a different manufacturer.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
They had two bundles, I think.
I think they used Aerojet engines, didn't they?
Aerojet.
Yeah.
Titan, yeah.
Okay.
They were the competitor.
Yes.
It was... Most of the data that we accumulated was from Atlas for Jupiter engines.
Okay.
Which were collectively known as B3s, booster 3s.
Mm-hmm. So your calculations also involved the diameter of these tubes?
Oh, yeah, the diameter, the taper of them, the resistance on them, the thermodynamic characteristics on the gas side. It's very complex.
Mm-hmm. Now, the construction of the tubes, were they basically straight sections with U-shaped joint? Okay.
They started out, they are double tapered tubes. They're round tubes that were double tapered so that you have a narrow spot in the middle of the tube.
Okay.
All right? And then it flares out toward both ends. The narrow spot is the throat.
Okay.
Then what you do is you take this tube and you put it in a die and you push on it and you press it from both sides, squashing it.
Mm-hmm.
So now you have a tube that has a cross section of two semicircles on each end and then flats connecting them.
Okay. I got it.
Yeah. Now, what you're striving for there is a certain cross-section for flow purposes to get your best heat transfer characteristics. And that was the calculations that A.J. Boxdollar did.
Okay.
The tube, by the way, the material, was Inconel X, which was brand new at that time. It's kind of think of it as a super, super stainless steel.
Unobtainium for its day.
What?
Sort of unobtainium for its day. Yeah. I love that word.
Yes, unobtainium. It was a real flyer. It had tremendous properties, but nobody had ever used it before. So Lou had to figure out how to braze this stuff.
And that required a huge furnace, I understand. Yeah. I've seen a small picture of it.
Yeah, it was a monster.
Mm-hmm.
The largest one ever built, I believe. Yeah.
I imagine there was only one furnace for this?
I don't know.
Okay. What, you mentioned that the fuel would flow down, it basically do a U-turn and then go back up, correct?
Right.
Did you ever do clear tube flow studies to see what sort of cavitation or restriction or anything like that would happen?
No, at the pressures we were dealing with, no cavitation was possible.
Okay.
But what we did on one occasion, finally we got a partial F1 built. And it was just from the injector face down to the 3-to-1 ratio, so it was a squat little devil.
Okay.
And before they put on the balance of the tubes, we grabbed it and we put it on the water bench and flowed water through it.
Oh, I see, okay.
And that was myself, Lou Benoni, and Don Welton.
Mm-hmm.
And what we did then is we got our bathing suits on, and we went out there, ran the water through, and it was spurting out the ends of the tubes because they had no manifold on them.
Okay.
And we measured with a tape measure how far they went. And from that, was able to calculate the flow rates through each tube each down tube.
Mm-hmm.
And from there, have to use that as a comparison against my program, and it was dead on.
Okay.
We had starvation problems.
Okay.
That's the extent.
What was the first significant testable engine that you were working on for the F1?
F1, the first testable engine, that was in 62, I believe. Early 62, it was right after I left.
Oh, I see, okay. Because you mentioned in your letter that there was a brief test with just a...
Yeah, that was with the iron...
Right.
Yeah. And that one, yeah, I witnessed that one. There was, I believe, one or two prior to that.
Okay.
And I don't know the date, but I would put it in early 1959.
Okay. How far was the Bravo 1 test stand from the Rocketdyne headquarters?
From Canoga Park? You
yeah,
mean?
Yeah.
Oh, gee, I don't know, 10 miles. It's in the west end of the San Fernando Valley.
Okay.
It's what's called the Simi Hills. Look it up on Google.
Okay.
As a matter of fact, if you look at Google, you can see the test facilities there.
Okay. They've pretty much stayed in the same location all these years, right?
Yep.
Okay. Okay.
It's also a highly contaminated spot, and nothing can be put there. It's a super fun spot.
Yeah, I see. Okay. All right.
They've been featured in some movies, too, by the way.
Well, you know, when I was doing this, I did come across an article about one of the contaminated sites type thing in California. Yeah, that's understandable.
Yeah.
It must have been a very, you were on the F1 engine work, it was basically 18 months or so. Is that right? January 60 to 61?
Me working on it?
Yeah.
Close to 2 years.
Okay. Then what other issues regarding the tube bundle design did you have to work on? Or did that move forward okay? Were there particular...
forward.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. We had it, actually Lou and I had it pretty easy compared to the injector guys.
Ah.
Yeah, that was where the bottleneck was.
You know, I have they, of course, and you're familiar with this, although I don't have it in front of me, it is called Project First.
Yeah.
They wrote a multi-volume set about the whole history of the
yes.
injector development and yes. instability problems and everything.
Yes, that took place after my time. I do have some of the volumes of that.
Okay.
In the form of a microfiche. You can get it from NASA.
Okay.
Not all of it.
Mm-hmm. What kind of hours were you working? Because it seems like everybody...
Normal.
What's that?
Normal.
Okay, because this was actually before the announcement was even made to go to the moon, so...
Yeah.
There wasn't...
I think afterwards, when they got into a real push on that injector, they worked all sorts of hours.
Mm-hmm.
But we were just 40 hours a week. I don't remember ever working overtime on it.
I see, okay. Okay.
The truth is, we didn't know what the thing was going to be used for.
That's, I think, one of the most fascinating things about this. Most people don't realize this until they get into it. I didn't know this, that it was conceived as a project long before...
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was just the Air Force knew they have to put big stuff up there,
mm-hmm.
and they commissioned a study on it. They were very forward-looking, very, very... I have to commend them for that, considering that most politicians and most people thought it was just Jules Verne stuff.
Mm-hmm. There seemed to be a number of key events like this that occurred before the announcement that all impacted America's ability to actually get there by the end of the decade.
Mm-hmm.
There was the Army Ballistic Missile Agency wanted a big booster, so that basically started work on the Saturn I.
Yep.
And which had a profound impact on the Apollo program. The F1 engine start before the announcement. It was another example. I'm sure there are a lot of things like this that all contribute.
Oh, yeah.
This
yeah.
thing should have taken 20 years, you know?
It would have, under normal circumstances.
But the
big push by Kennedy helped
mm-hmm.
an awful lot.
Mm-hmm.
Now, due to dates, I think I might have included a couple in that letter to my grandson, the dates of when the Air Force started this. And then it was turned over to NASA.
Yes.
After Sputnik. Sputnik caused an awful lot of commotion.
Heartburn, I'm sure, yeah.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Sputnik 1 was bad enough, but Sputnik 2 really was bad.
Yeah.
1,000-pounder. Oh, my God, what have they got?
Yes.
That was scary. That NASA then took it over, and NASA brags about the fact they were able to write this back in only 6 weeks. Well, of course.
Mm-hmm.
Of course they put it in 6 weeks. I'm surprised it took that long. It was already specified by the Air Force.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Now, this is, I got a thing about NASA.
A lot of people do. I'm thrilled about the new Project Constellation and the new Ares 1 and 5, but how long will it take them to do this, you know? I write an occasional column for the Space Review,
mm-hmm.
and I'll send you once this is published, I'll send you the link so you can read it, but it's titled, Will Technology Accelerate Ares Development?
Oh, very good.
Because, I mean, like you mentioned using slide rule, well, I did when I was going through engineering school too, but basically all the hardware for Apollo was designed with a pencil on vellum or ink on mylar,
yep.
Calculations done with a slide rule,
right.
And so forth and so on. There was very little technology to aid in the design, yet they did it in 8.5 years.
Yep.
And so my argument was, well, will technology accelerate development of these new rockets, or won't it, or will they get bogged down in bureaucracy, which is something
that... Oh, they get bogged down in bureaucracy.
Yeah, NASA does that very well.
Yeah, we were bogged down in it.
Mm-hmm.
There was more than enough politics going on that I was really not aware of, because I was just a wet-behind-the-ears engineer. It's very idealistic and all this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But in retrospect, I can see there was politics going on all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm surprised that we got anything done. But that's normal for any place now. You're always surprised anything gets done.
Okay.
Yeah. The Air Force started it, a study. First of all, it was a study. Can a million-pound engine be built?
Mm-hmm.
And Rocket 9 concluded, yes, it could be, after a sufficient study. The Air Force then gave a contract out for the E-1, an intermediate one,
mm-hmm.
400K.
Okay.
Because it was considered kind of risky to go from 150 to a million pounds, which is what they were talking about at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And the E-1 was quite a story in itself. You'd never hear anything about that, but Rocketdyne sweat bullets to get that one. It never flew or anything,
mm-hmm.
but it was a nice, neat little engine, 400K.
Mm-hmm.
And that was L. Boxdollar worked on that one, too. If you can find L, you've got a real good source there.
Okay.
Now, the next thing is, the Air Force then gave out a contract for a million-pound F-1.
Mm-hmm.
But then, I think it was under NASA, maybe it was under the Air Force, when they decided to make it a million-and-a-half-pound. I don't know the exact...
Okay. I'll be digging that up.
Yeah. Hmm. And we were working on it all along, in one form or another, for years.
Mm-hmm.
At least back in 56.
Okay.
Now, the F-1, then, when we did get the contract, of course, we were very excited and loved working on it, but there was always the question, what are they going to use this thing for? No one knew. There were always rumors in Aviation Week about all the latest configuration of Nova and such and such.
Right, exactly.
And then other configurations, and it became a bit of a joke to us. We weren't too sure what it was going to be used for.
Well, I think that little vignette that you described there with the... this gentleman who was always tweaking everybody for
yeah.
one thing or another. That's a great story.
Yes.
Did this person who blurted out what he knew it was, what he thought it was for, had inside information, or just hadn't, because the decision hadn't been made yet?
No, that was in 56 or so.
Gosh.
So the thought of going to the moon was, you didn't talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
I learned that back in high school.
Or they'd get out the white jackets.
Yeah, they'd get out the white jackets for you. But one of the things is you had to justify your existence there. You're not throwing missiles at Moscow. You're mm-hmm. doing something else.
Mm-hmm.
You can't really live with that.
Meaning you've got to know what it's for, right? Is that what you mean?
You've got to know it's for something other than killing people.
Mm-hmm. Right. Okay.
And the idealism of going to the moon certainly helped.
Okay.
And maybe that's what Kennedy had in mind, too.
Mm-hmm. It was a fabulous era lived through.
Oh,
I mean, the whole 60s, you know, it's just, and everything about it. So, what sort of events happened while you were there at Rocketdyne that you particularly really stick out in your mind? That because I, for me to write, you know, to write engineering history can be pretty dull stuff. But it's a very human activity, and there's a lot of engineering that can be written about in a fascinating way. And one of the ways I've found to do that is people saying, you know, I remember a particular story that, and they off they go. Now you've conveyed some of these in the letter.
Okay, here's a good one.
Okay.
This had to do with the injector.
Mm-hmm.
Now it's a flat-faced injector they were still sticking with.
Yes.
No baffles yet. Now this guy was 40 inches across in diameter, and every time they ran one of these things, it went unstable in less than 200 milliseconds and destroyed itself. And they were churning out these injector plates, just desperately. Changing the patterns. It was more intuition than anything. Now, we had a lot of data from the V3s and all, but it was so scattered. You could come up with almost any conclusion you wanted on the orifice diameters, on the pressure drops, yada, 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 all that. There are far too many variables. So they were trying everything they could think of and running a test. And, of course, they had to run these tests because NASA was looking, you know, are you running tests? Yes, we're running tests. Yes, we're making great progress and everything. NASA counted tests, they didn't count results.
Yeah.
And one of the injector plates, the machinist made a bad mistake. He misread some of the orifice diameters. I don't know whether he interchanged them between the fuel and the locks or what have you. But when they discovered that, the injector plate, which was costed at $20,000, had to be scrapped.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, he was fired.
Oh.
Now we get down to the crunch here. They've run out of injectors to try,
mm-hmm.
but they've got to run a test. They grab up this injector, all right?
Mm-hmm.
They stick it on the stand, they run it, it's stable.
Wow.
Yeah. That was the start of success.
I see.
Then it became necessary to put in the baffles. Now, baffles had been tested on V3 injectors. They never went into the Atlas or anything like that, or the H1, for my knowledge. But I know I did run a test when I was on Bravo 1B with baffles. The idea was to cut down on the resonances so that you wouldn't trigger the instability.
Mm-hmm.
They work. So finally, after many arguments back and forth between the purists and the practical people, they jimmed up this set of copper plates. I think that was 1-inch copper. They fabricated these baffles out of it, threw it on that injector, and it ran nice and stable.
Ah. See? I could only get neat stuff like that from you.
Yeah.
I mean, other people have written on this, but the really nitty-gritty stories like that are tough to come across.
Yeah. Now you think if I can... Gosh, you know, I haven't really thought of that too much there. I'll mull it over in my mind, believe me.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, you left the program long before they did any full-blown tests of this thing, but did you stay in touch with the team and find out what they were working on? And
not really, because at that point, a lot of guys were leaving.
Really?
And, yeah. And a couple of my friends that I worked with there came over and joined me at TRW Computers.
Okay, what was your attraction for leaving Rocketdyne and going to TRW?
There was a future in computers. There was no future in rockets. I could see that.
Ah. Well, you're right about the computer end of it.
Yeah.
And the rocket end of it was a big question mark, really.
It was. It was a big question mark, but in seeing the way they did... Well, there was an incident that occurred that convinced me that I had to leave.
Mm-hmm.
And it was this. I had been working on these programs. Gosh, I had programs to do this, that, and the other thing. I was really fascinated with computers. One day, my boss came up to me and says, Dan, says, we got a special project for you to work on for the next 6 months. And I said, okay, what's this? He said, we're going to do a design for the M1 proposal.
Yeah, I know Aerojet worked on an M1 proposal, but yeah. I don't know anything about it, really.
Well, I'll tell you the story.
Okay, here. Okay.
Now, the M1 was a LOX hydrogen proposed, 1 million pound.
Ah.
And he told me what the specs were, and I said, Eddie, Joe, I don't know anything about hydrogen here. That's the J2 group. And why don't you talk to them? He said, no, you're the one that's got the program and everything, and we want to see what it can do. Okay, fine. You got 6 months. All right, fine. And they arranged for me to move to another place. This became very suspicious afterwards, to another site a few feet away. And I started just gathering some information on hydrogen. And he came up to me a while later. He said, well, actually, it's just going to be 3 months. By the end of the day, it was overnight. Now, this is ridiculous.
It is ridiculous.
And being a young, you know, idealistic engineer, I'm not suspicious of anything. And so I packed up. I got enough cigarettes. I sat down, and I had an order to commandeer the 7090 any moment I wanted. And I started calculating like that. The next morning, about 9 o'clock, I turned all this junk over, because it was junk, over to Joe, and I said, that's it, I'm going home to sleep.
Mm-hmm.
And I came back the next day, and I said, well, what about the proposal? He says, oh, we're not going to propose. I says, what do you mean? Says, well, it's Aerojet's turn. All right?
Yeah.
I was being tested, I think. I didn't know that until much later.
Uh-huh.
Much later, but it just pissed me off so much.
Mm-hmm.
And what are they doing? And that's when I decided. Then I asked, well, Joe, am I still on the F1 or what? He says, well, yes and no.
Oh, yeah, that gives you
a big clue.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I said, well, what do you want me to do? Well, just keep working in your program. So I went and I interviewed for TRW and got the job.
Yeah, okay.
I may have been up for being fired for all I know.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. There were guys that were known as troublemakers. They kept insisting, you got to do this, you got to do this.
Or maybe they were trying to put you up to something, see if you could fail, and if you failed, then they'd give them an excuse.
Yeah.
I don't know. Who knows?
Who knows? But I did know there was another guy that was also working on manifolds. He was on the Atlas side, and he was really very strong pushing a certain type of manifold. He had his good reasons. He convinced me he was right. And he was laid off.
Hmm.
He made too much noise.
Wow. Isn't that a shame?
Yeah.
I mean, you do your job, you put your nose to the grindstone, and then you tell the emperor it doesn't have any clothes, and they fire you.
Yep. That happened at Rocketdyne.
Mm-hmm.
I think I know the guy that was, I think it was Jack Hahn.
Mm-hmm.
He was not my favorite person.
Well, I think
he was an engineering manager who didn't really do much engineering, but boy, did he manage, if you know what I mean.
Yeah. Or micromanages.
Yeah,
you
know. Yep.
Okay.
Bill Maurer was a great guy.
Okay.
He was an engineer's engineer. He was the one who was in charge of combustion devices. And he had the alcohol problem.
Oh, yeah, I saw that.
He was the kind of guy that stopped at your desk and just chatted with you.
Mm-hmm.
And got into the conversation. He could follow it.
Okay.
Jack Hahn couldn't.
Mm-hmm. Okay. You mentioned Bill Maurer, Jack Hahn, Joe Erbs, Lou, how many, if any, of these people might I be able to speak with, do you think? Do you know? It's been 40 years.
Alive, you can find them, I suppose. I don't know anything about where they are.
Okay.
Other than Box Dollar, I think he's in San Fernando Valley.
Okay.
But the rest, I don't know. I occasionally have looked up on the internet and that, and I can never find these names.
Okay, Al Box Dollar, I see that here. Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
I think Al stayed with Rocketdyne until retirement.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I'm pretty sure that just about everybody who worked on the F1 was laid off when Nixon cut things.
Yes.
Bang, that's it, gone.
Right.
No loyalty in aerospace.
Mm-hmm. No, and that's a shame. My dad worked for DuPont for over 25 years.
Oh, he was fortunate, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, he was in dyes and chemicals,
mm-hmm.
and did a lot of traveling and so forth, but
yeah.
That kind of longevity you don't see anymore.
No.
You mentioned in your email that you may have some photographs. Are these black and white 8x10s or what?
No, these are color shots, 35 millimeters. I have them on the computer, actually.
Okay, they've been scanned and...
Yeah, they've been scanned in, and they were taken by... Kevin Willoughby, who's a kind of a space cadet, follows the space program, younger guy in his 30s. And he went down to the Kennedy Center with his nephews, and he took some shots and sent them there's a couple excellent ones at the interior,
mm-hmm.
showing the injector and also the tube bundle.
Okay.
I thought you're going to probably need something like that anyway.
Yes, really. Yes, I am.
I can forward those to you.
Okay. What I'll do is, I don't know the size of these files, but I have a separate email account with Gmail, which is Google's email, that where basically the file size is unlimited. I mean, it can go up to anything, and I won't have
What's your download speed?
I'm on DSL right now, so.
Oh, okay. These aren't too big.
Okay. Okay. I'll send you from that Gmail account. I'll send you an email, and then you can attach anything.
All right. We'll do.
Do you have any? Probably not. But do you have any documents that you've kept over the years that might be relevant regarding
not.
Okay.
We weren't. Everything was confidential, I should point out.
Sure.
And we weren't allowed to take any documents home.
Mm-hmm.
And I never tried to smuggle any. So no, I never have had any documents. The secrecy was a bit funny over there at Rocketdyne too.
Mm-hmm.
I can tell you one story about the secrecy.
Okay.
This happened in 56. In December of 56, I'd just gotten my secret clearance. And by the way, there was rarely anything secret to see. Everything was confidential.
Okay.
And we were called up, a few people at a time, to go into this conference room if we had a secret clearance. And they were doing this all day, so what's going on? And then the people would come back and they wouldn't say anything.
Yeah.
And finally it was my turn and a few others, and we went up there and sat down and, you know, had to show our secret clearance and everything, and then some security type there said, "Now what you're about to see is classified secret, and you are not to discuss it outside of this room." And they showed us, it was going to be terrific. Well, they showed a shot of it was a Thor taking off from Cape Canaveral that must have lifted at least 6 feet before it exploded.
Mm-hmm.
That was it. You are not to discuss this outside of this room, except on a need-to-know basis. Well, I had no need to know this to start with.
Right.
And we went out and wondering, we can't discuss it with each other because nobody has a need to know this stupid thing. It was ridiculous.
It's like circular logic or something.
Oh, very much, yeah.
Yeah.
It was ridiculous. I kind of appreciated seeing the movie. We see it quite often on television.
Oh, now, yeah. So, of course.
The very same shot.
Yes.
Off a few feet and bang.
Yeah, we don't want this to get out, so don't tell anybody.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right.
Okay. All right. What I'll do is I'll do just what I've got here. I'm sure it will trigger maybe some other questions that I can ask you.
Sure, call anytime.
And then we can build on this and go from there.
I'll try to remember other incidents in that. I'm sure there are some.
And if you feel like dashing off an email, that'll suffice as well. So.
Yeah.
Okay, great.
Okay.
Thanks so much for talking with me tonight, I'll keep in touch with you, and we'll move this book idea along.
Great.
Okay, thanks so much.
Right.
Bye-bye.